North Georgia with expertise in education policy surrounding issues of public schools, the privatization of schools, and issues of equity and justice. Hello, Jameson. Welcome to Decision 2020. First question, the U.S. has a clear two-pronged approach when it comes to schooling, with white middle classes being at a clear advantage compared to the black lower classes. How do you think that this should be addressed when it comes to each of the mainstream candidates?
I think that it's clear that the United States has a historical equity issue when it comes to racial justice across our society, but especially in our schools. Something that we learned just last year that we've always known intuitively is that schools that dominantly serve white students receive approximately an additional $23 billion in funding per year. Now, of course, the significant portion of that difference is because the way that we fund schools is heavily dependent on property taxes here in the United States.
Wow, interesting point that he makes there. We appreciate that, James Brewer. He talked about equity issue and how white students are receiving, the schools that is, $20 billion more when it comes to their budget in terms of property taxes, perhaps. And of course, that is a clear disadvantage for the schools that have people of color in it. Well, when we take a look at the way that this situation is evolving in the U.S., keeping the schools safe is another challenge that U.S. administrations have been facing amid a steady rise in school shootings all across the country in the past decades.
Research shows that a majority of American teenagers are worried about the possibility of a shooting happening at their schools. Many students and parents are outraged by what they refer to as gross incompetence on part of school and law enforcement officials. They have repeatedly called for gun legislation and further school safety measures, but different U.S. administrations, whether Republican or Democrat, have flip-flopped on their pledges for new gun control laws. Although some state legislators have passed several gun control regulations in recent years, the National Rifle Association continues to press lawmakers to prioritize the interests of gun owners across the U.S. That shows that the fate of hundreds of thousands of innocent children lies in the hands of one of the most powerful lobby groups in the U.S., the foremost defender of the country's controversial Second Amendment of the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
Anxiety over potential school shootings has created a common fear among Americans, and many people persistently use any platform that they have to express their anger towards these senseless tragedies. Okay, back to our guest, James Brewer, professor of Social Foundations of Education, UNG, to talk about this violent practice and its consequences for the U.S. education system. James Brewer, welcome back. Gun crime and mass shootings is a major issue in schools in the U.S. Having seen multiple occasions where atrocities have been committed on school grounds, how do you think education can actually play a part in ending gun crime?
I think that it's also clear that the United States has a gun violence problem. I think that we have in this country approximately 2 to 3 guns for every person in our country. So I think that the answer to the question, I think that schools can play a part. I think that clearly teachers and educators and administrators and counselors think that they can, and historically they always have been, and we can continue to serve students and serve community needs and provide resources for students who are hurting, provide resources to communities and the broader society. But I think that the answer to the question, I think it has to come from a broad societal sort of examination of how this country approaches particularly gun ownership, but also the mass expansion of gun ownership over the past few decades, because I think that teachers and educators can play a part, but I think it'd be very difficult for teachers and schools by themselves to fix what is in effect a societal issue.
Okay, thank you very much. That is James Brewer, professor of Social Foundations of Education at UNG, with his comments on that. But I mean, he makes a lot of good suggestions, granted, but how can the U.S. president, who's saying that Democrat-run cities are the ones that are suffering from crime, if he's segregating it into those two categories, red and blue states, do you think there's going to be any solutions?
The U.S. economy largely relies on its vast infrastructure network. But these systems were built decades ago and they suffer from comparatively low quality. Experts are warned about safety concerns, and the American Society of Civil Engineering has given the U.S. infrastructure a low grade. Daily inconveniences for longer commutes, structural deficiency for bridges, antiquated drinking water, internet provision, wastewater systems, and air transportation all need upgrades and observations. That is while other developed countries enjoy more reliable and efficient services. Meanwhile, different polls show that the majority of American people and businesses support rebuilding the infrastructure. So why is the U.S. lagging behind its international peers such as France, Germany, and Japan in infrastructure? These discrepancies can be traced back to very different funding levels, either through tax, tolls, or private investment.
It seems that the U.S. infrastructure is in a dire state. Let's hear more about this.
We have 16 categories of infrastructure. We put together a pool of experts, about 30 different civil engineers who are analyzing. A lot of it is data that's available through the federal government. So we're looking at aviation, bridges, roads, transit, dams, levees, schools, parks, solid waste, drinking water, wastewater. So all of these different categories are analyzed. Unfortunately, 12 out of the 16 categories are in the D range, which is poor or at risk, which is really reflecting a lot of our infrastructure being at the end of its useful life.
More stimulus is needed. I mean, the two problems the economy faces, the two big headwinds are, number one, obviously the pandemic. And we're not going to see the economy fully recover until the pandemic is totally contained. But the other is we've got to have adequate money in people's pockets. We've got to have a stimulus that enables people to spend. And obviously, if people don't have enough money to spend, they're not going to be able to get the economy moving. The multiplier effect that comes from the bottom 80% of this economy's spending is really what this economy fundamentally depends on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's very alarming when you take a look at how, in that report by the engineers for the U.S. in terms of infrastructure as a whole, that you have actually drinking water in the D range. Four out of the six categories is in D range. Well, let's bring in our guests to see what the main economic challenges are that the U.S. Is facing in terms of its infrastructure. We're going to bring in William K. Black, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. William, it's great to have you with us. The U.S. infrastructure is crumbling. I'm sure you'll agree with that. You have roads, rail, and various hubs that are underfunded. How can the U.S. come up with the money to build this up? I mean, some estimates have, for example, stated that billions of dollars are needed and years of work to restore the U.S. water supply, which got a D, by the way, to acceptable standards. That's just one example.
Right. There are huge numbers of productive investments that the United States could make. It's not that everything is crumbling, but certainly we're a major contributor to global climate disruption, and certainly there are many productive things we could do to improve things like the safety of dams and bridges. Indeed, about 6 miles from where I'm giving this interview, a major bridge across the Mississippi River famously fell into the river and killed several people. And so this is a win-win. And the answer to your question directly on funding is the United States, of course, is a nation with a sovereign currency that can borrow or simply issue money in its own currency, even without directly borrowing. So this is modern monetary theory. The problem is not cash. The problem is political willingness. Indeed, it's an inside joke in the United States whenever you say infrastructure week is coming, because President Trump has been, you know, promising for 4 years now that next week he's going to do infrastructure, which would be have great bipartisan support. And of course, he's never actually done it.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to get back to you. I mean, talk about what he has said, political willingness. I mean, he just mentioned that there was a dam that was that fell apart and killed several people. You have drinking water, again, that had the D range, and people are getting sick off of that. Different states have actually cited that. So we'll see how this is going to pan out. As we already discussed, there seems to be a general consensus on the need for more resources for rebuilding the U.S. infrastructure. What is exactly standing in the way then?
Experts say the U.S. infrastructure faces a funding gap of more than $2 trillion needed by 2025. The intimidating specter raises the question of resources for financing the U.S. infrastructure needs. Many call for increased federal spending and a federal infrastructure bank to generate revenue and offer institutional investment to development projects. However, unlike the European countries that receive the major part of their infrastructure development funding from the national level, the U.S. federal government only provides 25% of the country's needed funding for development. Consequently, many argue that the presence of the private sector is essential. Those who are skeptical of federal government spending say the existence of a public-private partnership would be more efficient and cost-effective. Infrastructure is also critical to the employment rates in the U.S. These show that there is a need for a data-driven approach towards infrastructure funding rather than a politically driven one.
Okay, William, when we look at the impact of the COVID-19 virus hitting certain infrastructures more than others, maybe not directly, where should each candidate then be focusing his or her attention, in this case, his attention, when it comes to truly rebuilding America and making it great again?
COVID hasn't directly attacked infrastructure in the sense of destroying infrastructure, but it certainly has made it more difficult to do things like improve infrastructure by having construction projects that would be inside. And there hasn't been any political will on the part of the Republican majority leader in the Senate to do big infrastructure programs. And so we are in an unusual circumstance politically in which President Trump wants a large bill, including some infrastructure, and where the Democrats want it, but Mitch McConnell controls the Senate as majority leader and is, at least at this juncture, saying that he wants no legislation before the U.S. election, which is, in under 2 weeks.
Okay, thank you very much. William K. Black, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, talking to us there. He did fail to mention about the fact that you still have this almost $3 trillion stimulus package for COVID-19, people who are suffering from it. Add to that the large infrastructure bill that Trump has proposed. How are they going to get to that? They can't even agree on it, so it's a bipartisan issue. And that does it for this edition of the program. I'm Kavitath Lee. It's goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Ethic of Eight-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, salam dear listeners and welcome to the program. The 1975 Algiers Accord was the agreement that Saddam had signed with Iran's Shahs before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The accord set up the existing disputes between Iran and Iraq on the borders and the Arvand River. On September 17, 1980, Saddam tore up the Algiers Accord before the TV cameras and claimed Iraqi full control over the river. Then on September 22nd, the Iraqi army started an all-out aggression against the Islamic Republic of Iran along the common borders with Iran. Saddam sought three goals in invading Iran. First, he wanted to annul the Algiers Accord. Secondly, he wanted to separate Khuzestan province from the Iranian territory. And thirdly, he intended to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Iraqi dictator failed to achieve any of his ambitions of invading Iran. Therefore, as a result of 8 years of stiff resistance of the Iranian nation, he was forced to accept 1975 Algiers Accord again and give in to Iran's demands. Saddam, in his sixth letter to the then Iranian president, Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, while admitting the acceptance of the accord, wrote, "With this decision, anything has become clear, and thus everything that you wanted and stressed will materialize, and there remains nothing but exchanging of documents." The last British ambassador to Tehran, Anthony Parsons, wrote, "After Saddam reaccepting of the Algiers Accord, Saddam failed in invasion of Iran because of the Iranian resistance, and when he noticed that he could not dominate over Iran, he reneged on his conditions." After accepting the Algiers Accord by Saddam and withdrawal of the Iraqi forces from all of the occupied regions, it was the turn for implementation of other articles of the UN Security Council Resolution 598. The most important paragraph was the exchanging of POWs, declaration of the aggressor, and determination of the damages inflicted upon Iran. Former UN Secretary General Javier Pérez de Coya, in order to implement paragraphs 6 and 7 of Resolution 598, wrote a letter to Iran and Iraq on August 14, 1991 and asked the two countries to declare their reasons for the initiator of the war. This request faced with Iraq's ridicule, and the country presented a very hollow response on August 26 with a series of documents. But the Islamic Republic of Iran sent substantive documents in bulk form on September 15. The Iranian documents were based on Article 51 of the UN Charter pertaining to legitimate defense. The UN chief, after consultation with a group of his experts and studying Iranian and Iraqi documents, gave them to an impartial group. Finally, de Coya announced his opinion on December 9, 1991, stressing in an official report that Iraq was the initiator of the war. Part of Article 6 of the report reads, "The outstanding event that I have mentioned in Article 5 under the title of violation of international rights and regulations was the September 22, 1980 attack on Iran, which, according to the UN Charter, internationally recognized principles and laws or international morals, is not justifiable and leads to the responsibility of hostility. The UN Secretary General also said in paragraph 7 of the report, even if, before the start of hostility, there had been some aggressions from Iran to the Iraqi soil, such aggressions cannot justify the Iraqi aggression to Iran, which would result in the continued occupation of Iran's soil. An aggression that breaches prohibition of usage of force, which is one of the authoritative principles of the international rights. The UN Secretary General's report on announcement of the aggressor was a great victory for Iran. Although there were very obvious documents and evidence on the issue, the international community had kept tacit for several years vis-à-vis the aggression. It was in fact the Iranian resistance that forced the UN to bow to the legal demand of Iran. After this UN move, Saddam wrote a letter to Iran's president. As a matter of fact, his intention of sending letters to Iran was to settle his differences with Iran temporarily and cause Iran not to insist on implementation of other paragraphs of the resolution. Some of the Western and Arabic radios and news agencies said that Saddam's second time accepting of the Algiers Accord indicated that he was the aggressor and initiator of war. German radio Köln said, Saddam in 1980 started the war against Iran with ignoring 1975 Algiers Accord. Kuwaiti agency quoting Austrian diplomatic sources said, Saddam, who submitted before Iran and accepted Iran's conditions for peace, has officially confessed the initiation of war against Iran. The Saudi radio, also quoting military experts, said, accepting Iran's conditions by Saddam is the reason for the regime's invasion of the Iranian soil. Dear listeners, during the eight-year imposed war, Saddam's supporters in the West and the East didn't let even a single resolution be approved at the UN Security Council against the Iraqi dictator. Their ultimate request was the declaration of ceasefire without even mentioning the necessity of pull-out of the invading country from the occupied regions. The Western and Eastern powers and the regional cohorts and henchmen were seeking to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. They generously equipped Iraq with the state-of-the-art weaponry and provided it with the latest intelligence and logistical aids. Moreover, they assisted Iraq financially. Militarily, Saddam's army was the fourth army in the world with 1.8 million forces. It possessed 600 aircraft and 6,000 tanks. This army had gathered valuable experiences during the eight-year war. So, the Iraqi war machine had turned into a threat to the regional countries and the vested interests of the big powers. That's why they thought of annihilating this machine. It is naive to say that Saddam's aggression against Kuwait was only due to his ambition. There is ample documents and evidence to indicate that he invaded the southern neighbor upon the Washington's green light. This move gave the U.S. the pretext for military expedition together with its allies and accomplices to the region. The UN admission of Iraq's aggression against Iran was indeed to announce the expiry date of Saddam.
Around the World with Reporters.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists in front of the United Nations office. Journalists demanded an end to Israel's impunity and that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate handed a memorandum to UN officials demanding protection for Palestinian journalists. Since the beginning of 2019, Israeli forces carried out hundreds of attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Attacks against journalists are systematic and take place almost every day. Israeli forces target Palestinian journalists in almost every protest or event. Since last year alone, Palestinian journalists were attacked over 750 times.
According to human rights organizations, Israeli forces killed 43 journalists over the last 20 years. Additionally, hundreds of journalists were seriously injured, sustaining permanent disabilities that will probably accompany them throughout their lives.
The United Nations must come out of its silence and protect Palestinian journalists who are constantly subjected to Israeli crimes. Israeli forces have killed dozens of Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds more, while others are still in Israeli custody. We call on the United Nations to help bring Israeli criminals to justice at the International Criminal Court.
During the Great March of Return rallies, Israeli forces shot and killed two Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds while they were covering the peaceful action. Palestinian journalists say they work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
We are coming under deliberate and premeditated attacks by Israeli soldiers during the peaceful rallies. Israeli forces killed two of my colleagues and injured hundreds, and I was injured twice while covering the protests. Some of the journalists sustained permanent disabilities.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Israeli attacks against journalists have increased in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of Israel. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Flags at half-mast as Austria mourns a shocking terrorist attack that left 5 people dead and up to 17 others injured. The victims include an elderly man and woman, a young passerby, and a waitress. The attacker himself, who's said to have fired randomly at people, was shot dead by police. Authorities have now confirmed he was a 20-year-old with Austrian citizenship and North Macedonian roots. The unnamed individual was sentenced to 22 months in prison back in April 2019 for attempting to travel to Syria to join the Daesh terrorist group. He'd been released from prison in December. Interior Minister Karl Nehammer said it's a situation Austria has never experienced before. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz said the attack represented a hatred of Austria's way of life, pointing out that the enemy was neither a population group or a member of a religious community. Several people have already been arrested as police search for possible further perpetrators.
Vienna's inner city was at the heart of a large-scale anti-terrorist operation on Monday night. The now identified perpetrator was shot and killed by police shortly after 8 p.m. His apartment was forcibly opened with explosives and searched. As of now, downtown Vienna has been declared a red zone, meaning it's the most susceptible to possible further attacks. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Deaths in custody has been and remains a serious issue of concern for many in Britain in 2020, with countless individuals continuing to die in deeply suspicious circumstances while in the custody of the police. This year, the United Friends and Family Campaign, UFFC, launched their yearly March for Justice, with this year's event taking place online due to the current COVID-19 restrictions. Despite the calls for justice continuing over many decades, police accountability and real change remain as elusive as ever, especially for black communities, which, according to the facts, are more likely to fall victim to police violence.
I think that certainly the use of force, as described by the Metropolitan Police, the extent to which they use force when arresting black people, was 6 times more likely. And of course, because we're more likely to suffer mental ill health, that is always another recurring feature, overwhelming and disproportionate force, when actually what somebody needs is a caring environment, yes, restrained, but they're not criminal, they're just mentally ill. And so these are the kind of recurring factors that we see evidenced in black deaths in custody.
I'm the twin of Leon Patterson, who died in police custody in Denton in 1992, 27th of November. He was arrested on suspicion of stealing a till, which was then proved not to be the case. He was held in police custody for 6 days and was found dead in the cell on the 27th of November. The outline that I got from the chief superintendent was that Leon basically beat himself to death by throwing himself around the cell.
3 decades on from Leon Patterson's death, and like so many cases, no officer has ever been charged or brought to justice.
When we did remove the sheet from the body, I mean, it was a bit of a to-ing and fro-ing to remove the sheet, because he went, "You can't touch it." You had the morgue attendants trying to hold down the sheet, and the officer just kept standing behind me saying, "You do know this is all self-inflicted. You do know that he did this to himself." And that's when we turned him over and saw all the bruises on the back and down his legs. So to keep saying that this is all self-inflicted was mute.
Despite the calls for accountability and justice, far too many people fall victim to police violence, where far from upholding the law, they often break it with deadly consequences, knowing that they operate under a different set of laws which they themselves exist to uphold. Deaths in custody remains an issue disproportionately affecting Britain's black communities. Despite promises to enact reforms, many argue that Britain's police remains institutionally racist. Under the current government and with racism on the rise, this situation could get a lot worse. Richard Sudam, London.
In reaction to the stance of French President Emmanuel Macron in defense of the offensive caricatures of Prophet Muhammad, the Iranian daily Vatan Emruz published a cartoon of Emmanuel Macron represented as a demon, accompanied by the title "The Devil of Paris." This cartoon came after a wave of angry protests and reactions swept across the Muslim world, after the French president defended the Charlie Hebdo publication of the insulting Prophet Muhammad cartoon, declaring that France will not give up cartoons. The Macron remarks have triggered anti-French sentiments in the Muslim world, prompting calls for the boycott of French goods and an official apology.
I believe the republication of the offensive Prophet Muhammad cartoons is aimed at testing the unity of Muslims in the face of any sacrilegious act against their sanctities. The second point I think the French government is after is to make such insulting cartoons look normal and to promote hatred and Islamophobia in the world.
The publication of the cartoon of Prophet Muhammad outraged Muslims worldwide, but I believe the support of the French president for such offensive cartoons was much more insulting and indeed added fuel to the fire of Muslims' anger.
Daily Kayhan demanded that the French ambassador be expelled from Iran, believing that it would be the least thing to be done in response to Macron's insolence.
The publication of Prophet Muhammad's cartoon shows that the freedom of expression is just a pretext in the hands of the French government and its allies to spread Islamophobia across the world.
Meanwhile, leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei in a letter has urged the French youth to question the so-called reason underpinning French President Emmanuel Macron's support for insult against the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, in the name of freedom of speech. After the message of the leader to the French youth, the French Instagram account of the leader's website was blocked. The move is viewed by experts as a double standard policy of the West towards the so-called freedom of expression. At the same time, Iran's president Hassan Rouhani has said any affront directed at the Prophet of Islam is in fact an insult to human values, morality and freedom. President Rouhani has said that supporting those who insult the Prophet of Islam amounts to supporting vice, desecration and extremism. Also in a statement, 240 Iranian lawmakers lashed out at the French government for the move. Moreover, Iranians from all walks of life took part in a protest rally in front of the French embassy in Tehran to protest against the French magazine Charlie Hebdo and the publication of an image of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Iranians believe that fueling Islamophobia and hatred in the name of freedom of expression, which should serve understanding, empathy and peaceful coexistence between human societies, is regrettable. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Thank you.
These fighter jets are aligned in one of Iran's major air bases, dubbed Shahid Babai, located in Isfahan province. Their mission is to fly some 250 kilometers away to hit their simulated enemy targets. This is part of the last phase of a large-scale maneuver held by the Iranian Army's Air Force. During the two-day drill, Air Force personnel practiced air-to-air shooting, air-to-surface bombardment using smart bombs and rockets, and radar and thermal missiles. Military officials here say the drill was a success.
We conduct such drills to bolster our defense might. We need to be strong to deter any prospect of war on the part of our enemies. And what we learned through this maneuver is that we have it in ourselves to nip any threat in the bud.
Iran's Air Force, among other units of the country's military sector, have been under 4 decades of U.S.-led sanctions. This has led the Islamic Republic to rely on its own expertise to build up its defense arsenal. Last month, the United Nations Security Council terminated its arms embargo against Tehran amid a strong opposition from the U.S. Iran emphasizes that with or without the armed bans, the country is capable of defending its security.
The U.S. thought wrongly that its so-called maximum pressure against Iran would bring us to our knees. We proved during the sanctions that any pressure imposed by the United States is doomed to failure. Today, the lifting of the U.N. arms bans definitely gives us an edge. But more importantly, it isolated Washington on the international stage.
Iran's army says today the Islamic Republic produces over 80% of its defense equipment domestically. This, as Tehran underlines, that its military might is based on the doctrine of defense, and that the country will never be the first to pull the trigger. The Iranian Army's Air Force says it owes its might to decades of arms embargoes led by the U.S., which sought to undermine Iran's security. But in fact, it forced the country to stand on its own feet and indigenize its defense sector. And now that the arms bans are lifted, military officials here say this will definitely give the Islamic Republic an extra boost in its defense agenda. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Starting on Tuesday, November 3rd, there will be a second lockdown in Austria to contain a massive second wave of COVID-19 infections across Europe. All events will be cancelled. Hotels, restaurants and bars will close, and a curfew will be in place between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. Universities and classes for older students will switch to distance learning. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz told the nation, "We will have to do without a lot of what makes up our lives."
If the number of new infections continues to grow so rapidly, Austria's healthcare system, although it's one of the best in the world, will soon be out of capacity.
The country's health minister says Austria is in a race against time.
The turnaround must be achieved by mid-November. Otherwise, doctors will have to choose who to treat via triage. If we act now, we can gradually begin reopening at the beginning of December.
Health authorities are worried about the repercussions of an explosion of infections in October. On Saturday, more than 5,300 new infections were reported across the country, 5 times more than just 2 weeks ago. As a tourist and sport nation, Austria is affected particularly hard by the restrictions. The government has announced that affected businesses will get 80% of their revenue from the same month last year reimbursed if they keep all their employees on the payroll. Anyone not following the new rules could face fines reaching up to 1,500 euros.
The question that everyone wants an answer for is when all this will end. The definitive end of all measures will only be possible when there's an effective vaccine, experts say. Austria's Chancellor told the people he's confident they can have a normal summer again in 2021. Homa Leski, Vienna.
The United States' separating of Iran from the global financial system has hindered the Islamic Republic's ability to secure supplies of food and drugs as it struggled to rein in a resurgence of the coronavirus outbreak. The U.S. Treasury has time and again claimed that these items are exempted from the sanctions on the Islamic Republic. To delve into the issue, we talked to some MPs to see how Washington's targeting of over a dozen of banks has paralyzed import of drugs.
This is not true. Food and drugs have not been accepted from sanctions. In cases, the Islamic Republic has faced very cruel sanctions in its food and medicine sector. The United States has imposed unlawful sanctions on medical needs of those suffering from rare diseases. They are limiting Iran's access to raw materials to stir up anger among people.
One of the fields in which they are putting pressure on the Iranian nation is the pharmaceutical sector. Medicines are not used in military or nuclear sphere. The sick people need the drugs, but Washington has restricted the import of tablets and injection shots. This reveals their enmity with the Iranian people. I think our people are paying the price of standing on their own feet.
Drug and medical supply companies in Iran are now saying that the new sanctions have affected their work. Iran makes many of its needed drugs inside the country through pharmaceutical research, but treatments for cancer or rare diseases and transplants often rely on imports.
We must expand our knowledge. We must be aware that Iran will always be under sanctions by the Zionists and the U.S. Day by day, these sanctions will be expanded, so we need to have the knowledge to meet our needs by producing medicines domestically.
Iranians' access to medicine and their right to health is being threatened and may worsen if the situation does not change.
After sanctioning 18 Iranian banks as part of its maximum pressure policy, in its latest move, the U.S. government sanctioned Iran's oil minister, oil industry, and related companies. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
Afghans are marking the arrival of the birthday anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad under the name of Unity Week, at a time when Islamophobia is growing in some parts of the world and amid French President Emmanuel Macron's recent insulting comments about the Holy Prophet of Islam. People in Afghanistan are attending ceremonies like this one in Kabul as a show of respect and love for the Prophet of over 2 billion Muslims.
I'm here to show my strong support and deep love for the beloved Holy Prophet. Fortunately, we can attend different ceremonies that deepen our understanding of Islam.
We don't care about insulting words of individuals like Macron. This is especially because our leader, the Holy Prophet, has ordered us to be logically patient. Instead, we mark Unity Week to show how the followers of Islam's Holy Prophet ignore tensions and approve unity.
Based on Islamic beliefs, the arrival of Unity Week, as its title suggests, serves as a big opportunity for Muslims to once again return to the main teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, such as a strengthening unity among Muslims. Some others believe that the arrival of the birthday anniversary of Islam's Holy Prophet is also an opportunity for mankind to review the life and words of the Prophet Muhammad to see the real face of Islam.
Unity Week, in fact, brings unity among nations and Islamic societies like Afghanistan. I'm proudly saying it that Afghanistan is one of the leading countries of the Muslim world when it comes to the issue of Islamic Brotherhood.
I call on your audience to please study the true life and words of Islam's Holy Prophet. Yes, this is too important for anybody who is seeking truth about Islam and its honorable and holy leader, the Prophet Muhammad. Peace be upon him.
Besides calling for boosting Islamic Brotherhood among Afghans, those attending ceremonies marking Unity Week say the cementing of national unity among Afghans is one of the musts associated with Unity Week. As observers say, the best way to lead the nation to a real national unity is to remove the obstacles in the way of the ongoing peace talks between the government and Taliban in the Qatari capital Doha. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
A shutdown is being observed in Indian-controlled Kashmir after New Delhi amended and repealed a series of decades-old land laws of Kashmir. The new reorganization law issued on October 26, 2020, opens up all of Jammu and Kashmir to every Indian citizen and removes every restriction that prevented large land holdings. Allows the Indian armed forces to take over land wherever they desire and gives sweeping powers to the government to take over any land and property for industrial use and bring in big businesses to set up their shops.
People's Democratic Party President Mehbooba Mufti, while criticizing the government's move, accused India of land grab for big investors. The October 26, 2020 order repealed 13 state laws and amends 14 laws. Experts say this is to further the agenda behind the abrogation. According to historic date check, these laws were introduced to empower the majority Muslims who were suffering immensely under the non-Muslim rulers. Not only this, but the rights to buy and sell land in Kashmir were also confined to the people of Kashmir. Experts say India's move in Kashmir since August 5, 2019 has further internationalized this conflict. In response to the shutdown call by pro-freedom camp of Kashmir, shops and businesses remained closed. Huge number of government forces were seen guarding the streets to avoid law and order problems. Almost seven decades ago, these laws were introduced to empower the Muslim majority of Kashmir. But today, when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is repealing and amending the same laws, the people of Kashmir are watching over helplessly. Experts say this move clearly depicts India's intentions in Kashmir. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Under the Prophet's rule, Muslims reached the peak of global civilizations.
The Holy Prophet built a strong and logical foundation on the basis of which Muslims could reach the peaks of global civilizations for centuries, and could rise to new heights which were unprecedented in human history. His rule did not last any more than 10 years. You just see what proportion of a nation's lifespan could those 13 years and the following 10 years constitute? It is like a moment which passes very quickly. During such a short time, a great movement was started which could well be said to have divided human history into two eras, the pre-Islamic era and the post-Islamic era. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, pushed humanity forwards, strengthened the basis of morality, and left unforgettable lessons for all humans.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
You should consider the greatness of Mabath and from such a perspective. There were, of course, a number of interrelated factors which led to this success. But this success was mainly due to the Prophet being full of spirituality, purity, loyalty, and relying completely on God. This was a major and decisive factor in his success. Prior to his prophethood, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, was the most knowledgeable and the wisest of the people of Mecca. He was the most generous, respectable, and decent person in the area where he lived. Among those people, this prominent person enjoyed the blessing of God and the responsibility was put on his shoulders. This was because God had put him to the test before. God knew his servant and knew who he was assigning this responsibility to.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
The U.S. elections on the 3rd of November are keeping the whole world on tenterhooks as to whether Donald Trump will be re-elected as Republican president or whether, on the contrary, it will be the Democratic candidate Joe Biden who will win the election. But how could a second Trump term or a first Biden presidency affect the Middle East? Despite the obvious differences between Trump and Biden, there will be few foreign policy changes in the region. In matters of foreign policy, the reports of the Pentagon and the Council on Foreign Relations point out that the current and future challenges facing the U.S. and the region are to contain the Islamic Republic of Iran, to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, support the allies in the Persian Gulf and Egypt and Jordan, stabilize the situation in Libya and Iraq, and attempt to put an end to the alliances between Syria and Russia and Iran. Under this scenario, the next U.S. administration's prospects in the Middle East will be based on strengthening relations with Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt while maintaining a more combative position with Iran. Now, the current president has gone one step further and has even assured that he is not popular in the Pentagon. And this organization seeks only to be at war and be able to spend millions of dollars on arms purchases. For their part, the Pentagon's top officials considered that a precipitous departure of the troops could endanger, wait for it, peace in Iraq and Afghanistan. This might signal that the upcoming U.S. administration will advocate leaving what the Pentagon calls a residual force in Iraq and Afghanistan as a preventive measure against, wait for it again, terrorism. President Trump turned American foreign policy inside out to the benefit of some nations and dismay of others. Now, both groups are watching attentively to see which direction the U.S. goes next. However, West Asia is not holding its breath while the U.S. chooses its leader, simply because they've already been there and done that, and no good ever comes out of it. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. On the eve of the 2020 U.S. presidential election, it remains to be seen whether the Middle East is going to be used to galvanize support for a conservative nationalist foreign policy. In 2016, for instance, Trump's campaign often invoked the Middle East as a region where the U.S. has needlessly squandered blood and treasure. Furthermore, in September 2015, Trump pledged to deport all Syrian refugees, most of whom are Muslim, from the United States. Whereas for his re-election campaign, a paradox seems to be unfolding, with Trump touting his successes in the region as a peace broker. To discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Patrick Henningsen, who is the founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you for being with us, Patrick. Now, for all its stated desire to disentangle itself from the Middle East or the region of West Asia, Washington has really a hard time letting go here. But Biden and Trump represent two markedly different futures for some of the region's political elites in West Asia, especially their leadership in the Israeli entity and in a clutch of oil-rich Arab monarchies. How do you think the results will affect the region of West Asia?
Well, I think on the surface, it might look like they will present two different possibilities, two different scenarios for the Middle East. But if you look at U.S. history, what you'll find is from administration to administration, there's an incredible level of continuity between administrations that might appear to be being from different parties, for instance, or different personalities, totally different, but really the underlying policy is very slow moving in the United States. In the current situation, looking at Syria, looking at Iraq, for instance, there's definitely a drift away from previous policies by the U.S., so they're moving out, essentially, in the larger scheme of things. So, in terms of the Israeli issue, I don't see a massive difference that will happen between a Biden administration and the Trump administration. I think, who knows, the Biden administration could be more beholden to the Israeli lobby or as beholden as the Trump administration. I don't see any noises being made otherwise. Certainly there's some to be gained with some of these other issues at play, like the JCPOA, but I'm not convinced there's going to be a massive difference.
Well, a new U.S. administration could signal a dramatic reversal of Trump's old policies in the region, where it's believed that it would seek maybe to patch the damage that he caused with the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially with the nuclear JCPOA deal, and maybe cool the tensions down. But why should Iran trust any U.S. president if, let alone in 4 years from now, a new, Republican president could come to office and just revoke another agreement?
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head, Marwa. They shouldn't. And I think Iran has learned this lesson. The Islamic Republic of Iran has learned this lesson already. And I think they're moving ahead with their future, with their plans. They should be looking to China